Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I am John Manuel. We're coming to you from the DeMarini Demo House Media Nook at World Headquarters of BaseballAmerica.com. And we thank our friends at DeMarini who now sponsor these podcasts. And when it comes to buying a baseball bat, DeMarini just changed the game, introducing Demo House, where you can step into the cage and hit the latest from DeMarini before you buy. Because there's no substitute for hitting a real baseball, J.J., or talking to people who know both bats and batting. Your demo time in the cage is free, so get the season started right. Visit your nearest demo house today. Locations and full details can be found at demarini.com/demo house. And again, we want to thank DeMarini. We've been doing these podcasts for 3 years, JJ. We're very happy to have a sponsor. I think the podcasts are a lot of fun. We enjoy doing them.
Hopefully y'all enjoy listening to them.
And they've been free for 3 years. So they're still going to be free. And the reason they're still free is DeMarini and the Demo House. So welcome to the Demo House Media Nook. JJ, a very action-packed third week of December, I guess it was, in baseball. We had a somewhat somnambulant winter meetings. And then we've had an incredibly active week with free agent signings. And one of the biggest trades in recent memory, we had a good-sized three-team trade with some big names last week at the winter meetings. But this week, Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, and a lot of big-name prospects involved. So let's just dive right into the trade. And, you know, the way that things are today, winners, losers. Is anybody lose in this trade? How would you rank the three clubs as far as who got the most for the least out of this deal between Seattle, Philadelphia, and Toronto?
I got to go Seattle number one because I don't think that they gave up they gave up talent.
Right.
They gave up three prospects. They gave up, center fielder Tyson Gillies. They gave up right-hander J.C. Ramirez and right-hander Felipe Mont. None of those three, though, I think hit that level of slam dunk, top, elite prospects in the game.
Yeah, Ramirez wasn't even in the Mariners' top 10. I think Matt Eddy had him 18th for the prospect handbook that goes to press tomorrow here at BA World Headquarters. So we're taking a small break from that to bring you this podcast. But yeah, it's amazing. Not even
Gillies
three top 10 guys.
Gillies is a very intriguing leadoff center fielder type prospect, but I'll put it this way: he's not anything like Michael Taylor, who the guy that Phillies traded away in this deal.
Anything like him at all.
But that's not replacing, we lost one outfielder, we got another outfielder.
He's not the same caliber of player, I agree.
He may fit a little bit more long-term what they need. They have Dominic Brown to be the right fielder type that Michael Taylor was. But
crazy thing, I think they have someone in the system who might be faster than Tyson Gillies and Anthony Ghost. And they have a guy in Juwan James who's almost that fast. So they have – speed was not an issue for them. So Gillies is an odd fit, I agree.
But so to take that, from the Mariners' side, to get Cliff Lee
– for those three guys.
At a reasonable deal for this year. Now, you only have him for this year right now. And it looks like that you probably will only have him for this year, and then you could negotiate like everyone else does after the season. But to get Cliff Lee, if you look at the Mariners, I think the Mariners among American League teams, it's hard to find someone out there who's done more. If you look at the Seattle team now compared to the Seattle team a year ago, a lot of reason to be excited if you're a Mariner fan.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt they made the right hire in Jack Zarenczyk, and there's no doubt that Jack has made a lot of moves where not every single move that any general manager makes is going to work out. But he just he's had an aggressive, focused direction for that team. They've gotten more athletic. They've gotten better defensively. And they've been decisive. When they've seen a player they want or a move they want to make, they make it. They're willing to pay a price for talent, and they're willing to be aggressive with those things. And whether it was their draft last year, which I thought was not a consensus draft, Steve Barron and Nick Franklin with their third and second picks, to be precise. Those picks were not consensus picks, but they're very convicted in them. And I happen to like both those picks as guys who I think can defend up the middle, and those are hard guys to find. Those picks fit right in with the rest of their philosophy, and they've executed it from the top down. You just have to be – I think this move just fits in. Everything that Jack has done over there has been aggressive and smart. So it's not wild aggressiveness. It's smart,
it's not
focused, philosophical, aggressive. Yeah, it's been it's a very consistent approach in Seattle, and it's very impressive to watch from afar. I agree with you. I think Seattle is the biggest potential winner in this deal because Cliff Lee for 1 year, in my mind, is worth three guys, none of whom projects to be a star.
At the same time, look at the Phillies. And I think you can say at the Phillies, hey, the key part of this for the Phillies is they got Roy Halladay not for next year.
Right.
They got Roy Halladay locked up at a really what has to be described as a below market deal, especially because of the number of years.
Right. I think he's right. I mean, I think $20 million a year for a pitcher is hard to say below market, but 3 years.
3 years is below market for a pitcher of his caliber. I mean, like, if you compare that to the Sabathia deal, you compare that to other pitchers.
Hey, John Lackey just got 5 years.
Right.
I mean, not the same money, obviously, but he got 5 years.
But to lock up one of the best pitchers in the game and only have to lock him up for three more years, that kind of gives you all the ups, that, a lot more of the upside and a lot less of the potential downside than, you know, a 5 or 6 year deal as we've seen. You know, we've seen 7 year deals in the past. Thankfully,
those don't happen too much anymore.
7 year deals don't really work out too well for
people. Usually, the team that gets the best player in the trade wins the trade. I mean, there are cases where that's not true, but I think this is one of those. I still think the difference between the prospects that Philadelphia gave up and what Seattle gave up, you know, Seattle gave up so much less in my mind for just the 1 year of Cliff Lee. But Cliff Lee is close to Roy Halladay. I'd rather have Roy Halladay as a pitcher, but Cliff Lee's not far off. I mean, he proved he was a number one in my mind with his playoff performance this year. He was very good in the regular season, not as good as Halladay, but you know, I'd say good to very good, and then he was great in the playoffs.
And let's put it this way. You can't say, hey, if we'd had Halladay, we'd have, you know, won the World Series.
Right.
Because if you replace Halladay with Cliff Lee, you don't win any more games.
Correct. I think you're correct.
I mean, that was not what – now, if you say you replace Cole Hamels with Roy Halladay and you kept Cliff Lee in that rotation, then you – yeah, okay.
Or maybe if you just replace Pedro Martinez with Jay Happ.
Right.
I mean, they might have had the solution in-house. I do think the Yankees were the better team. But yeah, I think Philadelphia gave –
I was going to say, the thing I don't understand, though, is that – I know that it made the money work, but if the one problem, I guess, if I had any problem with this from the Phillies standpoint is that I don't mind even giving up Drabek to get Halladay, because, I mean, you're giving up one of the better pitching prospects out there, but you're getting you are getting one of the best pitchers in return.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Arguably, you're getting the best pitcher in the major leagues.
Right.
I mean, you could definitely make that case.
But since you had Cliff Lee locked up for next year, to me, it would have been preferable to have moved other pieces. I would rather even lose a little bit of long-term flexibility to try to keep, you know, Cliff Lee. I would have rather traded away a Joe Blanton or, you know, and even some other pieces, if possible, to keep Cliff Lee.
I agree, and that's the only flaw in the whole thing, I think, for Philadelphia is Cliff Lee at $9 million or Joe Blanton at $7 million. I would have taken pennies on the dollar for Joe Blanton.
I would have taken a Millwood Johnny Estrada deal.
Yeah, that's right. Something akin to that, exactly.
Where you say, hey, we're getting rid of him just to get rid of the salary, even though he's got value. But I would, to have Cliff Lee for that year, you would have been
I have to imagine a team like, say, Milwaukee that's just desperate for starting pitching, or some of those teams that think of themselves as contenders would take on that Joe Blanton contract for no – what would you rather have if you're Milwaukee? Would you rather have to go sign the pool of free agents or trade nothing for Joe Blanton, keep your draft pick – trade we don't know what happened, what the internal discussions were with Philadelphia. Maybe they tried to trade Joe Blanton
and
really
did
not like the sound of what they were going to get back.
Right. That's all potentially possible. That's the one, if you had a complaint. Now, so what do you think about it from the Blue Jays' side?
Well, I mean, I think the Blue Jays did what they had to do. They clearly were over the barrel with Roy Halladay, and I think you have to give Alex Anthopoulos and his crew credit in that they did not – they got more back than Minnesota got. Just worked finishing the Twins' top 30 the other day. And, you know, Phillip Umber's gone. He's a minor league free agent signed with the Royals. Carlos Gomez, they flipped and turned into J.J. Hardy. And Kevin Mulvey, they flipped into John Roush. So what they have left is Deolis Guerra in AA. He finally got the AA. Yay! J.J. Hardy, who's nice, but is coming off his worst season. And John Roush is a middle reliever. And that's what they have to show for Johan Santana. And it's actually more than you think about. It's more than you would have thought, because before, when it was just those other players, and they kind of did well to flip Kevin Mulvey into John Roush.
And let's make clear,
this is not even a hindsight.
At the time.
Yeah, at the time.
It was not something where you said, wow, they really got these guys for Santana.
At the time, the best the Mets have, and that's not very good.
Right. I mean, it was something where at the time you said, well, I guess that's the best they could get. However, you thought that an ace pitcher should probably bring more than what they got. They got four throws at the dartboard.
Kind of.
Then they not four. You know, Kyle Drabek is a significantly better prospect now than any of those four guys were then. And I would say that Michael Taylor is a better prospect than any of those guys were at that point.
I think I bet there would be some scouts who at the time would have taken Carlos Gomez over Taylor just because he's such an electric player. And there is question about Michael Taylor, the swing plane, and just his contact-oriented approach, that Stanford hitter approach, where he obviously has adjusted very well as a pro. He's hit 334 over the last 2 years. His power is kind of average,
right.
I think you'd say. And that's the I think the complaint is that how is this guy going to be a star? No one sees this guy being a star. But if he hit 333 with 20 home runs every year, he'd be a star. Heck, if he hit 300 with 20 home runs or 18 home runs.
15 home runs with a little bit of ability to run like he has.
Yeah,
he'd
be a very good player. I think that Michael Taylor's – I think in some ways, maybe last year ranking him sixth in the Philly system might have undersold him a little bit, and that he had a higher ceiling than, say, Lou Marson or Jason Donald. Or Carlos, probably not a higher ceiling than Carlos Carrasco, but that was a pretty stacked top six last year when you think about it. I think Marson and Donald are both going to be big league semi-regulars this year if they're healthy in Cleveland, and Carrasco will be, looks like he's going to be a part of their rotation. So we'll see how good those guys are. But Philadelphia has traded its prospects 2, 3, and 4 now in back-to-back years. So I mean, the Blue Jays had to trade Halliday. Their haul of prospects was pretty good. Right now, we're going to press with, and we had this in the chat the other day, Kyle Drabek steps in as their number one prospect for an organization that desperately
needed a number one.
And if they didn't have Kyle Drabek, I think Brett Wallace, who they flipped Michael Taylor for Brett Wallace with the Oakland A's, I think Brett Wallace would be a respectable number one prospect.
Yes.
So that makes their system look a lot better. And Travis d'Arnaud slots in at, we could have made him 4 or 5. We went up with him at 5 and JCR and CB at 4. JP Arncibia. What's his first initial?
JP. Yeah.
JP. We still have some residual good feeling for Arncibia from his 2008 year, but he needs to start. Take a pitch every once in a while, JP. It wouldn't hurt.
But
he's the only JP left standing in Toronto.
The best way to put it was that when we saw Zach Stewart as their number one, Zach Stewart was their number one before this, another guy that they picked up in trade.
Right.
There really was not. I mean, the Blue Jays
farm. The cupboard has been left extremely bare.
Yeah. Well, Zach Stewart, when you saw him at number one, the best way to put it was he'd make a really good number four, number five prospect in the system.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's more of the feeling. And, hey, now he's the number three, number four prospect in the system.
And it makes a lot more sense. And the one thing I will say is that in a small defense of the Blue Jays, a big reason why those guys, why their farm system looked so bad is they graduated guys like Mark Zepchinski and Brett Cecil so quickly to the big leagues. And if you added a little bit of pitching depth to their top 10, you know, if those guys hadn't been graduated, it would have looked better.
The reason it looks the reason it looks bad is that those guys have graduated, and then when they went high school draft that year,
their 07 draft is terrible.
None of those guys have panned out.
They had a draft bonanza that year, and from the college guys, Tristan Magnuson, he's turned out terrible so far, and he had a bounce back year this year. But the rest of their guys they drafted, the Tolosanos, Aarons,
Jackson,
Eric Island, it has not gone well for Toronto. So this
was a much needed. I like as far as Toronto, more than anything else, they had to trade Halliday partly because the whole hey he's not going to agree to a trade during the season and all that.
Right.
But more than that, Roy Halliday, as good as he is, it's smart for Toronto. Toronto's operated. Partly by necessity, JP Ricciardi could not come out in 2008 and say, "Hey, this group is not good enough to win.
Right.
We're going to blow it up, and start over." He couldn't do that because if he did that, he was essentially saying, "Fire me."
In 2008, I do think that they really thought that team would be good enough to compete. The big because they still had Alex Rios at that time was still a good player. Vernon Wells, you just never know what you're going to get with Vernon Wells, but more often than not, you're going to get average, and then. He's kind of like Darren Erstad. There are a couple of years in there where he just has giant years. But they also still had B.J. Ryan, and they were paying him big-time closer money. And some of their pitchers were healthy, like Dustin McGowan. You know, I think it was 08 when they had the great pitching year, and they just didn't hit. But they really have when their hitters hit, they didn't pitch. And when their pitchers pitched, they didn't hit. I'm not saying that their plans were the right plans. I did not respect their process at all. But they had some bad luck, number one. And then number two, they really didn't draft well. Over the whole course of the J.P. Ricciardi regime, they were at the one extreme where they weren't even scouting high school players. And that really brings me to, as the rest of the podcast, talk about a couple stories going into the next issue as we develop some of the news that happened, both Rule 5 draft and this Blue Jay story, and every issue where we have our American League, if we have a top 10 prospect from that division, our Prospect Pulse is dedicated to a feature about player development in that division. And this one being the American League East, JJ, you did a feature on the Blue Jays scouting changes under general manager Alex Anthopoulos. And that's it's a fascinating story we're going to get to talk about a little bit right now as we're coming to you in this Baseball America podcast. John Manuel and JJ Cooper coming to you from the DeMarini Demo House Media Nook here at Baseball America World Headquarters. And JJ, the Blue Jays are just completely expanding they're doubling their scouting department, basically. And they're going from 14 to 25 area scouts, 10 to 21 pro scouts. I think I agree with you. The pro scouting changes might be even more profound than the amateur scouting changes.
Right. What they're doing on the pro side is that they're going to have each pro scout is going to be responsible for two organizations. So they will be responsible two organizations from Major League down to
Complex League.
And in the past, it's been something where they've been responsible for, like, an average pro scout had, like, five organizations, which is not unusual. I mean,
right.
On the other end of the spectrum, there are other organizations where their amateur scouts get done with the draft, get done signing players,
right,
and then head on out and, go scout, pro side. And not that their amateur guys aren't going to do a little pro scouting also.
Right.
But the idea is that if you have a scout who's scouting two organizations head to from top to bottom, he's going to develop a really good feel for that organization because he's going to see these players a lot more than, really, I would say, than any other, team scouting, another organization.
You certainly hope so, and I think that's
that would be the idea.
That's one thing that I've always wondered about. How much can you really get when you have a guy go in and do 1 week, he sits on a team for a week to do his pro scouting, and, how much can you really read makeup out of that one-week look or that kind of thing, or see a pitcher one time, a starting pitcher one time? So to me, I really like that approach, the philosophy of that approach. It seems like it makes a lot of sense for Toronto. And I guess the doubling the amateur scouting staff also, how's that going to be set up?
So what they're going to do is they're going from 14 to 25 amateur scouts at the area scout level. They're also going to have – they've also added a level of regional cross-checkers. They have now national cross-checkers, and then they're also going to have regional cross-checkers who are responsible for basically four to five – cross-checking four to five different areas.
Right, and that's a big difference. I guess the way that one of their scouts talked to me about it at the winter meetings was basically five cross-checkers, like you said. Then he has five – each one has – four or five scouts under him and the way it's divided up. And it's really every scout has a smaller area so you can go see players more frequently. And hopefully, instead of having to bear down on your, picking six or seven guys early and then bearing down on those guys, you can bear down on 10 guys. You can bear down on 15
guys.
Right,
because, one of the things it's going to cut down on is that a lot of what you do is, you've got to do coverage. Part of being an area scout is doing coverage. You have
right.
to see everyone in your area at least, once or twice. Everyone who's draftable,
right,
ideally.
Right.
Well, if you have a smaller area, you get done with your coverage, and then you can go back and bear down on your top guys or a sleeper who really interests you.
Yeah, and maybe you can get a sleeper cross-checked, potentially,
right.
and you have more cross-checkers.
Right, something that you could not do in the past. The other thing that I think that they did that was interesting, and I think is something that makes sense and teams should do on a regular basis, is they also did a study to look at, from 2000-2009, Major League debuts, where'd they come from?
Right, that was
simple question.
An interesting idea.
Simple question, but you should every now and then check. It's something where you may find, hey, this area that we thought was a hotbed's not a hotbed anymore, or this area that we didn't know the hotbed is.
Are we scouting this area enough where these players are coming from in this modern era? That's smart.
An example that they found was that Northern California, the Bay Area, ended up being one of the most productive areas in the U.S.
Yeah, no doubt.
They had a scout whose responsibility was Northern California, Oregon, Washington,
right.
Idaho, most of Nevada, Montana. That scout was spending a lot of time. Obviously, Oregon's been a pretty productive area, too, and also
sure.
that scout was spending a lot of time outside of Northern California. Well, when they reorganized this, they said, hey, we look at this. We've got a scout who's just going to do Northern California.
You might be missing Dontrell Willis, which doesn't sound like much now, but he did win 20 games 1 year, or T.C. Sabathia, or Jimmy Rollins, or their own Brett Wallace, who's a Northern California guy, right, who apparently really wanted to play for the Oakland A's and is probably unhappy that he's not.
But so it's just basically any time a new regime comes in, even though, and I'll point out, the interesting part with this is that the new regime is part of the old regime.
That's right.
Alex Anthopoulos came up through the Blue Jays.
It really gave him his break. I mean, his first job was with Montreal, obviously, and he's a Montreal native. But the Blue Jays gave him his first significant job that's baseball operations.
You know, and so with that, it's something that – but the new regime coming in, you always kind of get that chance to kind of take a look at things and do things a little differently. And the best way to sum it up, I mean, and, you know, this – we, you know, wrote this in the story. The Blue Jays are in many ways going back to a lot of what they did before, because – the Blue Jays were a scouting, you know, based system. Not that, you know, every team is interested in scouting. They do it different ways. But the Blue Jays were very much a traditional, you know, believe in the scouts, trust the scouts, and use them to basically stock a system to keep us going. And that was – and
that's how they won two World Series.
Right. And so the idea is that kind of bring back some of that pride in being a Blue Jay scout, and it being they want being a scout for the Toronto Blue Jays to be something that scouts for other teams aspire to be.
There's definitely a quality of life issue in there as well, that you have a smaller area to travel around. Theoretically, you're at home more. Theoretically, you're happier scouting for the Toronto Blue Jays than if you're scouting for someone else. Definitely, there's a focus on scouting and player development. There's a value placed on scouting and player development in that organization that they're hoping that will be greater than other organizations.
And that's the key part. The last part you said, like, I talked to a couple of scouts about the whole, like, you know, getting home more often and all. You know, they talk about having more days off and all.
Yeah.
And talking to scouts, they said, look, that sounds great. I'm a scout. It's going to be really hard for me to be at home when I know that someone from another team, a scout from another team, is going to be going seeing a guy I like.
Well, I can't see the thing with that argument is I can't see a guy being at home and just choosing, well, I'm supposed to have more days off and not going to a game. But I think that you're just going to be closer to home.
Right.
You may have a smaller area.
You may be able to drive home more often at the end of the night.
Yeah, exactly.
That may happen.
I think that's the difference.
But the key part you hit on the end, the key part about, to me, as far as long-term about this working about being a destination and all, comes down to, do you believe in your scouts? Do you give them the ability to give their opinions and then show that you believe in their opinions?
Right.
So that's the part that I think is really going to be a key to this because, you know, scouts say, hey, all the other parts are great. And the Blue Jays treated their scouts. They paid them well. You know, I mean, that was really one of the
probably
things.
Probably too
that,
well.
You know, they
$70,000 for an area scout. That's twice the going beginning rate anyway.
Well, they paid them well. They treat them first class and all that. But talking to scouts, the thing they say is the most important thing to me is that when I give my opinion, does it matter?
And that's huge.
They want to believe that what they do matters.
That's
makes
huge.
Sense.
And I would imagine that's challenging in organizations that go out and sign. I was thinking about this when I'm writing the Yankees top 30 again, and that just went online. And, you know, I just wonder, most of those guys, when I finish writing up, like, the future for a lot of those players, and even though we don't use that in the book for 11 to 30, I still write that. I have that mnemonic kind of device in my head. And, you know, to me, most of those future players are trade bait or they're reserves. I mean, like, the Yankee profile, if you're not a star caliber player,
then you're not going to play.
I mean, like, and that's the thing, the rare exception is Melky Cabrera. If you really think about it. Because at least Brett Gardner, he's not a star, but he does have an 80 tool. I mean, he's an 80-run guy. So that's a difference maker. But Melky Cabrera is really just an average across-the-board guy. I mean, below average power. I mean, he hit 13 home runs this year in the new Yankee Stadium. That's a career high. So that guy's an average hit, and you give him average hit. Maybe even fringe average because he doesn't walk, so his on-base is always kind of okay. Below average power. Average to plus defense, but this is not like a 70 defender, and he's not a 70 arm either. So that guy is really the exception. He's been a regular for the better part of 4 years for New York, and he's homegrown.
But he really is
the exception. As a rule is, if you don't have premium tools.
If you aren't projected to be, I mean, really the best way to put it is if you're not projected to at some point be an all-star.
Yeah.
As a position player.
Just forget it.
Pitching, a little different.
Right.
They have pitchers because no one, even the Yankees can't afford a pitching staff.
And they had a homegrown bullpen this year. It was a complete, in the playoffs, other than Brian Bruni, it was completely homegrown.
But as a position player, you know, I mean, the best way to put it is Jesus Montero, who we're talking, you know,
that's right,
the number one prospect. there's a possibility he's trade bait. Like, he's either a DH or a trade bait probably for them because
the logical places
that he can play, well, you know, if you can't play first base, they have
maybe,
an all-star.
Maybe he could learn to play left field, but he hasn't played it yet. So if he's going to start playing left field, if they wanted to play left field, I'd leave him in the Florida State League in 2010. And he's already proved he can match that league. If they want to play left field, then he'll go to Trenton next year. But their plans are, they say, send him to AAA Scranton. He's in a catch. He's in a DH. He might play some first base. They've never mentioned left field, at least not to me. So it's the Baseball America podcast. He's JJ. I'm John. We're in the DeMarini Demo House Media Nook and wrapping up the podcast. JJ, with a little Rule 5 talk. We may as well talk a little Rule 5. But it's not. It ain't what it used to be. The old Brown mayor of the Rule 5 is not what it used to be. Was there anybody in the 20 players picked this year that was interesting to you?
No, but I will say though we have a little different opinion on this and that. I actually said this to you before the Rule 5 draft. I said the guy, if there's anyone who makes an impact, there's a pretty good chance that we're not even talking about him right now because.
That might be true.
Like, Everett Cabrera was not a guy that anyone was talking about. He was
not necessarily.
No one was talking about him as the number one pick in last year's.
Not going in, but he was one of the more interesting names on the board. There's no doubt he was one of the most interesting names on the board. It was hard to imagine that he would stick, and it was hard to imagine that he would play 100 games and have a 740 ops.
Right.
No, that's what was hard.
The thing about this is that most years – There may be a couple of interesting guys, but it is something. It's very hard. There's a reason, especially when we talked about it when they did the rule change. Now that you had one more year, there are very few players out there who teams have a real tough decision. Oh, do I put them on the 40-man?
Right, and that's the thing. I think if they had the old rules, honestly, if guys who are 2006 first round picks, college players, that's what I meant to say. If 2006 college players had been eligible in this Rule 5, in the old rules, I bet you that MLB Network would have put that on TV. Because all you have to do for the Rule 5 draft is say, Josh Hamilton, Johan Santana, Dan Uggla, Joakim Soria, the Rule 5 draft on MLB Network next. Or, you know, if there was anyone interesting, also if they had anyone of video. But, I mean, you look at your 2006 college picks. I mean, like, Ian Kennedy probably would have been protected. Would Brett Sinkbeil have been protected? Would Matt Antonelli have been protected? Probably not. Kyle McCullough, I can guarantee you, would not have been protected. There are a lot of guys on here who, or supplemental second-round picks, who may not have been protected. Mike Felix, I mean, I think he's pretty terrible. Ronnie Borquin banged for...
Some of these guys would not have been protected, and they would have...
Stephen Wright, you know, at Hawaii. I'm sorry, I won't do my Stephen Wright impersonation. But here's a guy who went 10-0 at AA as a middle reliever. Would the Indians have protected this guy or not? He does have a good slider. I think he would have been useful, and I do think that it would have been much more difficult and a much more interesting draft under the old rules. The talent pool was deeper. And the real question I have, or what I wrote about in the upcoming issue of Baseball America, is why would you draft someone in the Rule 5 draft under these rules who doesn't have upside? To me, the whole point is to draft upside. If you're drafting like the Yankees did, and I'm not critiquing the Yankees, but just using them as an example, they drafted Jamie Hoffman. Jamie Hoffman is basically filling the role that maybe Austin Jackson might have filled on the big league team this year, which, of course, they wouldn't have done this with Austin Jackson. But a right-handed hitting outfielder who can play all three positions and play good defense in the outfield in your fourth/fifth outfielder role. That's why they got Jamie Hoffman. They are not going to start him. He's not supposed to be an everyday player. But why would you get that in the Rule 5 draft and not, say, develop it yourself? It shouldn't be that hard to develop that. Or, number two, minor league free agency. That's the part I just don't quite understand. Is Jamie Hoffman really that much better, where a minor league free agent brings you so much more roster flexibility, you can send the player down, these kind of things? That's where I wonder about the role player Rule 5 draft pick. Does not make sense to me because of the limitations.
But I think it is because of, I mean, really what comes down to is economics in that, I mean, it sounds silly, but you drafted Jamie Hoffman because you're talking about a league minimum, fourth outfitter, that really, we talked about
a minor league
a
free
bit,
agent wouldn't
but,
be that?
Well, you actually have to pay the minor league, sounds crazy, but you do pay the minor league free agent, probably a guy who is capable of doing that role of going up and down. You probably actually end up paying him a little bit more
than the minor
month to month.
The major league minimum, you don't
think? Yeah, well, if he doesn't make the team, though, then that's the thing that comes.
I see what you're saying. You're paying him, you're still paying a minor league salary that you might pay to someone else.
Right.
I mean,
but
I don't
what
think
it really comes down to is
$100,000 difference.
Part of it, what it comes down to is that the money that is involved this has become obsolete.
Trivial.
Yeah, because back when it started being $50,000, $50,000 actually was the amount of money that you had to think about.
I was like a major league player's salary.
Right.
You know.
Whereas now $50,000 is,
it's a pittance.
It's a pittance when you talk about that with the major league. I mean, when you're talking something that's less than a fourth of what the less than a sixth of what the major league minimum is.
Yeah, less than like an eighth.
It's like
$410,000, I think,
so
is the minimum.
So you're talking about it makes sense at this point. Why wouldn't you raise that to say, okay, it's $500,000?
Yeah.
If you did that, then
no
you wouldn't
see
these role players. You know,
right.
But maybe they don't want to do that, but that would actually then you would see a five person,
I'm not sure how you quote unquote fix the Rule 5 draft. I don't think it needs fixing.
I was gonna say it's not that important. It's something that's interesting to watch in December.
Right.
But it's not important enough. They're talking about fixing the regular draft.
Right. That's
spend
much more
your time
important.
There.
But I would definitely say that I think the Rule 5 draft has always been it's definitely a prospect nerds kind of event, and there's nothing wrong with prospect nerds. I'm a prospect nerd myself. But it's less interesting even for a prospect nerd now than it used to be. And I think that's something of a problem. They've almost made it completely obsolete and irrelevant with the rule change.
Really what it comes down to is a couple of years ago when they said we're going to add an extra year before you have to be eligible for the Rule 5. Really the best thing the Rule 5 draft does right now is – for the players who were on that bubble who got put on the 40-man roster.
Right.
You get to go to big league spring training.
Like Hector Noesi.
Right.
Or like Loke Van Mill.
All those guys who were in danger of being picked, who teams put on the 40-man, who would not have put them on the 40-man otherwise.
And I had a crazy idea about it, and we'll wrap up on this for my fixing the Rule 5 draft, which is really, I swear, not a big priority for me. But if you did add a tweak to it, maybe the amount of money that a guy signed for would affect how long you get to protect him. Because I do think for some players, it's better if they get a chance to be outside the organization and have a different organization take a look at him. But for other players, in my mind, if a team sinks six figures into a player, if they paid you a $100,000 bonus or higher, then you can get an extra year of protection. But if they signed you for less than that, then I think three years, if you're a college pick or 4 years of high school, you go back to the old rule. You know, we've seen you. We didn't invest a whole lot of money in you in the first place. That means we probably drafted you as an organizational player and make him really make a decision on those guys. And if that player doesn't fit your organization's needs, maybe he fits someone else's.
The one thing that made me, when you said that I thought of is that the thing that does sometimes get lost is I didn't think the Rule 5 is often bad for players. Because you have players who are not ready to be in the big leagues. That's fine. They get carried on a roster.
Right.
Usually, especially to me, it's not ever Cabrera proved to be the exception who actually stuck and was able to hold his own.
Right.
But it's often, especially going back years, it used to be that you had these good defensive shortstop second baseman who said, hey, we can carry that guy for a year.
Luis Huguetto.
Right. We can carry that guy for a year because he's got a good enough glove that he can serve as a backup.
Yeah, I remember a guy that the Cardinals carried, Miguel Mejia, all year.
The Brewers took a Cruz as the number one pick.
Oh, yeah, the guy of the Mets system. Cruz.
Enrique Cruz, 1 year. But those guys, what happens is you take a guy who's already – the bat's the question.
Right. They're already a little
off. And
then
you take a year and say, you know what?
You're
not really going to improve your bat this year. You're just going to actually regress because you're going to get no at-bats, and the bats you get are just going to show you how overmatched you are.
The Rule 5 draft would be perfect for if basketball had – if the NBA had actual developmental league, because the NBA in basketball, you actually can get better – just practicing with better players. But you just can't do that in baseball. It's a game sport, not a practice sport. And you play to win the game, to use Herman Edwards' quote. I've got all three major sports now.
But so basically you have these guys who really, maybe they probably wouldn't have been anything anyway.
Yeah.
But you kill their chances because what happens is they spend a year in the majors and then they go back to Double A the next year. And a lot of times with their confidence shot because, wow, I can't hit these guys.
Yeah, exactly.
And they kick around as usually they kick around as a veteran AAA utility infielder for years after that. But I wonder if there's some of those guys who would have been something if it hadn't been for the fact that they spent a year that they lost development time.
Well, that would be my Rule 5 tweak. If I were to tweak the Rule 5, I'd say guys that the teams had to really invest in $100,000 or more, they get an extra year of development on that for those players. But if they sunk less than that into the player, they go back into the pool into the
I
old
like
draft.
That idea.
And that would, yeah, see, it's not that crazy. And but I think it's a tweak that would make the Rule 5 more interesting and make the pool of players a better pool of players. But lots of what we covered on this edition of the Baseball America podcast. So, JJ, I appreciate your time. Remember, you can email us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. We do not have any emails this week. This will probably, I'm going to guess, be the last podcast of '09, JJ. Last podcast of the '09. We're going to squeeze one in next week?
I think we can probably squeeze one in early next week. You know, we'll have it set up to be maybe a little Christmas gift.
If not next week, the week after Christmas, we probably will do one because we'll be in the office a little bit for that. I know that Aaron Fitt and I, in January, will come at you with our first college podcast of 2010. From the ABCA convention down to Lowe's in Dallas.
Maybe I can loosen up the vocal cords and give you in the year 2010.
If you do that for next week's special podcast, that would be tremendous. That would be coming to you from the DeMarini Demo House Media Nook, as Baseball America's podcast is now sponsored by DeMarini. Because when it comes to buying a baseball bat, DeMarini just changed the game, introducing Demo House, where you can step into the cage and hit the latest from DeMarini before you buy. Because there's no substitute for hitting a real baseball or talking to people who know both bats and batting. Your demo time in the cage is free, so get the season started right. Visit your nearest demo house today. Locations and full details can be found at demarini.com/demo house. So for DeMarini and for J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.